So today is November 14th, and it's our sixth class on stories of men and women in the Talmud.
Did you?
I gave out, I think I put two sheets on the table there. And what we're going to be focusing on today, as the sheets say, is Bruria. Has anyone ever heard of Bruria?
Yes,
As a woman.
She is the
book,
she's mentioned
woman?
There?
Yes.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
And in order to understand a little bit about Bruria as a scholar, a daughter, and a wife, we're going to have to look for a background about rabbinical stereotypes of women. No problem at all.
Thank you.
We're not going to make a complete study of rabbinic misogyny, which means the stereotypes about women, but we're going to see some things that come up in the stories of Bruria we're about to see. So at the top of the page, I quoted in an English translation from the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Kiddushin, Nashim Datan Kala, women are lightheaded, which, by the way, we saw in the previous class, remember?
Absolutely.
Now, what does it mean that women are literally Datan Kala? The word Kala means light, or fickle, or movable.
Right.
Or not Kala, not bright, but
no,
light.
What is the word? Forever a bride, the person that is called.
A bride.
That's
Kala. It sounds the same. It's written with a different...
Right.
Kala is with a kuf,
in
the sense of light, and Kala with a chaf is something else. So in the context that we saw it just an hour ago, remember, the idea was that she wouldn't be able to withstand torture. In other words, she's easily manipulated. It could mean that. It does mean that in some contexts. It could mean a certain lack of stability and a lack of a conviction that allows you to maintain stubbornly your opinion in the face of others trying to convince you. Someone who's Datan Kala, they can be easily swayed.
Could it be light of knowledge, like because women didn't study, could be...
Yes, it could mean, and some have interpreted to mean that women just aren't intelligent. Don't know anything. Can't think. So again, it could be both intellectual and emotional. It's not clear. In the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai that we saw just an hour ago, it was emotional. It wasn't intellectual. Now... this is stated a few times in the Talmud. It's hard to say. Is it an accepted opinion, not an accepted opinion? It appears in the Talmud. It doesn't mean all the rabbis agree. But on the other hand, you don't find rabbis disagreeing. And I think that everyone who studied Talmud a few years has heard of such a thing. And it's part of the culture of Rabbinic Judaism. Now, of course, let's just remember, it's been part of the culture of Western society until 60 years ago. Right, it's not like Rabbinic Judaism is especially against women. It's really just reflective of things that most people believed for thousands of years. See it in that context. Another statement that's going to appear and come up in the stories of Bruria. Rabbi Yoshua says, a woman prefers to live on an income of merely one bushel and yet have tiflut, that's the Hebrew word, from her husband, rather than live on 10 bushels of income earned by a husband whose need to work away from home condemns her in practice to a life of ascetic denial. So, this is probably a reflection.
Only
a man would think that way.
Probably a reflection of what most men thought about all women. Let's just understand what it says.
I understand exactly. So,
I know. How do you? I'm not sure I understand. So, this word tiflut, is certainly a word that has an ambiguity attached to it. What we can say about the word, it's certainly connected to physicality and sexuality, and it's certainly something negative. In this context, it looks like when the rabbis say tiflut, they mean affection. They mean sex, but not just sex. They mean physical contact. They mean the emotional bond that's based on the physical contact between husband and wife. And they're saying that a woman is not willing to forgo that connection, that affection, even if it means she has to suffer loss in income. The man might want to go leave Israel for a job in Dallas to make more money or to serve the Jewish people, whatever it might be. I'm not talking about me, but just in principle, right?
All of the above.
And the woman, she's only concerned with tiflut. She doesn't really need the money. She's not concerned with the higher values. She just wants her husband. That looks what Rabbi Yeshua is saying, and certainly from the point of view of Rabbi Yeshua, it's a criticism. It's clearly a criticism. They don't understand, those women don't understand proper values. Now, the truth is that if we take the critical layer away from it and just see it as a male understanding of women, I think I can understand where it's coming from, right? I hope you don't throw rotten eggs at me. Mm-hmm. But I think that John Gray, remember John Gray? Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Yeah, I think he would agree, that doesn't mean this is the truth, but I think he'd agree at least, that women tend to value human contact, connection. They put a value on the affection of marriage, much more than men. Here, at least in translation, the word sex appears. Perhaps the word sex doesn't have to be there, but affection, human contact. Whereas the rabbi seems to be making light of that emotional type of stuff. What do you need that for?
So tiflut means...
The word tiflut, again, is ambiguous. I can tell you two things about what it certainly means. It means something connected to physicality and sex, and it's certainly a pejorative word.
Oh.
Certainly pejorative. So those two statements are in the background of the world that Bruria lives and works and studies in. Now, just to add a little bit of a cultural breath to it, I wrote a third paragraph here. Wives have great joy with various sorts of clothes and the suitable station as the mistress of the house. But when they have no sex, they fall into depression and confusion. And they have no joy in these things, but only depression and boredom. When they have sex, then they're even happier than with these other things. And that is a non-Jewish source from the Zoroastrian tradition. In other words, it's from the culture in which the Babylonian Talmud was written.
Yeah. I would say that every widow would have no joy in life.
Don't take it personally, Dorothy.
No, I'm saying that I find it incredulous that people
too
think
extreme. Too extreme.
It would be like, I'm not saying that sex doesn't have a major role in people's lives, but there are times of your life where you live your life without sex and people are not in depression.
Right.
It just makes zero.
Yeah, good. I'm not trying to defend
this. Frame when women couldn't, I don't know when this was written.
This was written in the Babylonian period, about 1,700
okay, so
years ago.
In that time frame, a woman didn't have somebody to take care of her.
True.
Yeah.
True.
But people didn't live as long, so they
people maybe didn't live as long, and their children would take. But yeah. I mean,
and a woman didn't work outside the home or have all kinds of other activities.
But I don't see how it's relevant
today.
No.
I'm not saying anything about today. I'm just saying that this is part of the cultural background
that we come from.
That Bruria was part of. We're about to learn about Bruria.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's tied to our sense to nature and nurture and birds. And I mean, I think it's just all part of and to be needed and to need and to, you know, as men are, you know, hunters and hunter gatherers.
And men are more independent,
yeah.
And men tend to, at least here, look down on that type of need for or value in affection and warmth and human nearness.
I just think it's part of our human makeup.
Yeah. So Myra, by the way, if you guys here, is saying that there might be some truth in this,
so
right? Might be some eternal truth in it. And I would agree that it's certainly based on something, but it might be grossly exaggerated, and it might be a snapshot of a culture that's no longer the culture we live in.
For sure.
And by the way, if we're talking about stereotypes, it relates to the previous class about all the stereotypes that we talked about Muslims. We often live by stereotypes. That's the way we organize our world, for better or for worse. The next quote, I just thought you'd get a kick out of. Dr. Charles Meigs explained to his all-male gynecology class in 1847 that a female has a head almost too small for intellect and just big enough for love.
1847 was not that long ago. In the scheme of things, wow.
So again, our modern world that tends to appreciate women beyond these stereotypes, our modern world was only born 40 years ago.
I mean, we only got the right to vote in 1920.
I know.
Right.
So
yeah.
70 years after this quote.
So that's background.
Didn't think we had the smart enough to vote.
That's right.
That's background. Wow. Now let's start learning about Bruria. For all that is said about Bruria in modern Jewish life, and you guys said most of you've heard of her, mm-hmm. in the Talmud there's very little. But that very little shows a woman so unique and so out of her element, so different from her culture, I should say. Out of her element doesn't apply. So different than her culture, so swimming against the tide of what's expected of women, that, wow, who was she? Where did she come from? So here are four or five Talmudic statements, short statements about Bruria. Bruria learned 300 ritual laws in one day from 300 rabbis. Now, if you think about it, why did she learn, how did she learn from 300 rabbis?
She must have sat in on one of their study sessions.
Okay.
She read it.
No reading in these days. It's all oral. No reading. She had to learn from the rabbis. So it doesn't say she learned with 300. It says she learned from 300.
300 from the past, all that accumulated.
I'm not sure, because that would really mean that you mean she heard it all from one rabbi telling about 300 rabbis? Yes.
She heard from 100 rabbis telling about 200 others.
So you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking that she went to a rabbi and she asked to learn a halakha. He taught her. She said, another halakha. And he said, no, women aren't supposed to learn. So she went to another rabbi. And learned one. She asked for a second one, and he said, what do you mean? One's enough for you. She went to 300 rabbis.
How can you do 300 rabbis in one day?
It was a busy day.
5 minutes each, 5 minutes a rabbi.
It's a metaphor.
Perhaps it's exaggerated, right? It's exaggerated. But the point might be that you learn from here her desire to learn, her dedication to learning, and that she was turned away. She wanted to learn more from this particular rabbi. She was always turned away. She had to, with great perseverance, go from desk to desk until she learned all that she learned. And apparently she remembered it all, understood it all. But the rabbis probably were very suspicious, and that's why they wouldn't teach her more than one halakha each rabbi. Another source. An oven which was plastered in ritual purity and became impure. From whence can it be purified? We talked a little bit about ovens and ritual impurity in our class about Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer in the first session of the first hour 5 weeks ago. We don't have to go into the details, which I myself don't know, but you have an oven, which is a big earthen creation that's on the ground, and somewhat got ritually impure, a dead person touched it or something, and how do you purify it? Rabbi Chalafta of Kfar Hananya said, I asked Shimon ben Hananya, who asked the son of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodyon, and he said, when they move it from its place, so when you move it, it becomes pure. I don't know why. I'm not sure. But his daughter said, when they disassemble its parts, that when you take one part out of it, and you put it back, it becomes a new thing, and it's lost its old status of being impure. When this was told to Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, he said his daughter said it better than his son. Now, who was this daughter of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion? Well, this man, this rabbi, is Bruria's father. And it looks like it's referring to Bruria. We'll learn later that Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion had two daughters. But there's no mention, well, there's mention, there's a hint to the second one, but what is spoken about mostly is his daughter, whose name was Bruria, the daughter of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion. And it looks like we're talking here about Bruria. So she knew the halachot of ritual impurity and purity, which are the most complicated halachot. And not only did she know them, but now look closely. What did we just read? Let's read it again. Rabbi Halefta Kfar Hananya said, I asked Shimon ben Hananya, who asked the son of Rabbi Hananya ben Tordion, and he said, when they move it from his place. But his daughter said, when they disassemble its parts. So what exactly happened? So someone asked the son of Rabbi Hananya ben Tordion, who gave an answer, but the daughter said differently. Was the daughter asked? No. What does it mean she said differently? What happened? Apparently, someone came to the son, who's a rabbi, asked him a question. Bruri is in the other room, or she's on the couch. And she says, no. What my brother said is not right. I'll tell you the answer. And then, later they checked it out, and she was right. So we learn from here, not only does she know, but she's willing to speak up, even when she's not asked. She's a certain degree of what we call chutzpah, a certain degree of assertiveness. She's not afraid or embarrassed or modest overly to prevent her from speaking up, even when it means contradicting her brother, contradicting a man in matters of Torah. This doesn't usually happen, you understand. So not only do you not usually find learned women, you certainly don't find learned women who speak up when they're not spoken to in the presence of their brother who already gave an answer. That tells us perhaps something about the personality of Bruria. Another story. A doorbolt. Rabbi Tarfon declares it impure, but the rabbis declare it pure. The question seems to be, can a doorbolt, is it susceptible to ritual impurity? If a dead person, touched by a dead person or someone has ritual impurity, is it susceptible to ritual impurity? Again, no need to go into the details, and I myself don't know them. And so the rabbi said that it's pure, Rabbi Tarfon says it's impure, and Bruria says, one removes it from this door and hangs it on another. Which probably means that she holds that it can become impure, but if you take it apart from the door and put it back in a different door, it loses its ritual impurity, very similar to the previous case that we had seen. On this Shabbat, these matters were referred to Rabbi Yehoshua. He said, Bruria said it well. So, yeah.
I don't think it only says something about Bruria. I think it says something about her family and how she was raised and how it was probably a rabbi might have let her sit in on his discussions. I think it says as much about this.
Okay, that certainly could be, but we...
Because at that time they didn't include the women, so
they probably didn't, but perhaps her father was a unique teacher. The truth is, we're going to learn about her family in another few minutes. We really do want to know something about her family. So we see again from this source that Bruria knows what she's talking about. And just like in the previous source, the rabbis, at least some rabbis, acknowledge that she knows what she's talking about. On the intellectual level, no one denies, apparently, that she knows Torah. She's learned a lot, she remembers it, she can analyze it. And here's the story at the top of the next page about her family. Kind of a sad story. This is a midrash on the Book of Lamentations, the Book of Eicha. And in the Book of Eicha, we find the following verse. I wrote it in italics at the top of the page. He has also broken my teeth with gravel stones. He has made me to wallow in ashes. In the context of the Book of Lamentations, this is the prophet Jeremiah speaking about God. That God has made us, the Jewish people, he's broken our teeth with gravel stones. That's a metaphor for the destruction of the temple and the suffering of the Jewish people afterward. He has made me wallow in ashes. And that's the verse that the following midrash is based upon. What does the Midrash say? It is related of the son of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion. Remember that that's her father, Ruri's father. It's related, it should be more clear, Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion is her father, and the son is her brother. Mm-hmm. It's related of the son of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion that he became friends with robbers whose secret he disclosed. We'll have to ask ourselves, what does it mean, friends with robbers? Did he just befriend them in order to find their secret and give it away? Or does it mean that he got involved with them somehow? Does it mean that he accepted stolen property or actually became perhaps a robber with them? It's not clear. So they killed him and filled his mouth with dust and pebbles. It's like the mafia, right? This was an assassination, and they wanted to make an example of him. They filled his mouth with dust and pebbles, saying, "You should have kept quiet." After 3 days, apparently held the body hostage for 3 days, they placed him in a coffin and wished to recite a eulogy over him out of respect for his father, because the father was a big rabbi. But he would not permit them to do so. So if the robbers wanted to say a eulogy out of respect for the father, it means they wanted to say nice things about him in the eulogy, right? But the father didn't allow it. He said to them, Rabbi Hananya said to the robbers, "Allow me and I will speak concerning my son. I'll give the eulogy, not you." He opened his discourse, the eulogy, and said, "I did not pay heed to the voice of my teachers, nor incline my ear to my instructors. I was in dire trouble in the midst of the assembly." I mean, I made trouble in the midst of the Jewish people. That's the way the father eulogized the son, with a verse from Proverbs. In other words, the father did not say nice things about his son. The father apparently knew that his son had gotten involved in criminal behavior with the robbers, and he deserves it. Can you imagine a father getting up in front of the congregation and saying in his son's eulogy, "He deserved it. He was a bad kid." Mm-hmm. So in this family, there's no sentimentality. He's not cutting his son any slack. Even at his son's funeral, the father is not saying anything nice about his son. This family has a high standard of behavior, right? They're upright people, they're Torah scholars, and if the son didn't live up to it, he failed his father, he failed his mother, he failed his family, and he deserves what he got. And his mother recited over him, "A foolish son is the vexation to his father and bitterness to her that bore him." So first of all, the mother of the son, that is to say, the wife of Rabbi Hananya, she knows Torah. She's quoting from the book of Proverbs. So she's, to a certain degree at least, a learned woman. This is the mother of Ruria. She's a learned woman, but she has no sentimentality, just like her husband had no sentimentality. You'd expect the mother to say, "Oh, my poor son, I loved you so much, you could have been a good kid, what happened to you?" It's all missing. All she has is criticism for her son who went off the path and did evil, and he deserved what he got. His sister, and I wrote there in brackets, it might be Bruria, it's probably Bruria, although there is another sister we'll hear about later, recited over him, "Bread gained by fraud is sweet to a man." In other words, he robbed for a while and it was good for him, but afterwards his mouth shall be filled with gravel, from Proverbs. So she is as harsh concerning her brother as her mother and father. So she's learned something from her family. She's part of that family. She's not a complete black sheep or different. Right? She's learned from mother and father. But further, I want to point out that if you look at the verse that she finds to recite over her brother's dead body and compare it to the verse that her mother found and her father found, her verse is the best, because it describes exactly what happened. And again, she didn't make this up. She's just quoting from the book of Proverbs. But she knew how to search through the whole Torah and find the exact verse that fits the situation. So then you say, wait a second. She's a woman. Her father just eulogized his son, the mother eulogized, and then she speaks up, and she's not ashamed to give a better eulogy than her father and mother. I'm not saying that's good, I'm not saying that's bad. But she's a woman of, she asserts herself. She perhaps even knows that she knows as good or better than her father and mother, and she's not ashamed to express her public learning, her learning in public. Now, a very famous short story, which a lot has been written about, and it's a very strange story. Rabbi Yossi the Galilean, in Hebrew, Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, he comes from the Galil, was once on a journey, and in those days, journeys are on foot, when he met Bruria. So he's walking on a distance, and he finds Bruria walking also. By what road, he asked her, do we go to Lud? Oh, it's a fork in the road, how do we go? Do you know directions? Forgot my GPS. Stupid Galilean, she replied. Didn't the rabbi say, do not enter into long discussions with women? You should have asked more concisely, which Talud? We have to analyze really what went on here. So, Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, who's a big rabbi, the first thing she says to him is, stupid Galilean. She stereotypes him. You're a Galilean. And those Galileans, they're idiots. She stereotypes him. And to his face, she exclaims, you don't know anything. What does it mean you don't know anything? Don't you know what the rabbis taught in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot? Al tarbe shichai misha. Don't talk a lot with women. So why are you talking to me? You're a hypocrite, she says to him. Because you didn't have to say, by what road do we go to Lud? You could have said just three words. Lud, where? So obviously, she's being sarcastic. Right. She knows that when the rabbi said, don't have long conversations with women, it doesn't matter if it's five words or seven words. She's making fun of the rabbinic statement that says don't talk to women. She's making fun of it. She's sarcastically belittling it. And she's saying that you don't live by the statements that you actually teach. So what do we learn about her? She's smart. And she's sharp. And she's aggressive. And perhaps she's even bitter.
Yeah.
Right? She knows that she's as smart as any of these rabbis. And she knows what these rabbis say about women. And she's not just belittling him, she's belittling the very same rabbis that she wants to learn from, she does learn from. So she has a very, nuance is not the right word, she has a very conflicted approach. But she wants to learn Torah, she does learn Torah, but she also is lacking respect for those rabbis who teach Torah because
they don't respect
her. They don't respect her. Right? Now you can imagine why so many articles and books have been written about her, trying to reconstruct the personality of this unique one in a million woman who in this society went completely against the grain. Another story. Bruria once discovered a student who was learning in an undertone, which means that he wasn't learning out loud. Now remember, this is the era of Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law. Everything is oral. There's no books. And the way we learn Torah is by reciting it out loud, repeating it, thinking about it out loud, going back and forth with a chavruta partner to understand. And she finds in a corner of the Beit Midrash a student who's just thinking to himself, and he's not learning out loud, or perhaps he's just mumbling, but he's not enunciating the words as he's studying by himself. So what happens? Kicking him, she exclaimed, isn't it written, ordered in all things and secure? If it's ordered in your 240 limbs, then it will be secure. Otherwise, it will not be secure. Can you imagine the chutzpah of a woman who walks into the Beit Midrash, kicks one of her father's students, and says, you got it all wrong. You're supposed to be learning out loud. Why are you mumbling? And she quotes a verse to prove her point. If it's ordered in your 240 limbs, including your lips, if Torah is found in your lips and in your tongue and not just in your mind, then you'll have it secure, then you'll remember it, but this way you're just going to forget what you're learning.
Do we know how old she was?
No. We have midrashim that talk about her marriage, and that she had at least two kids who died at a young age.
That was what was in Ezra Driven Leaf. It talks about that and how she told her husband about it.
That story is there. Yes. We learned that story in our Thursday morning class last year. Yeah, very powerful story. I'm planning to bring it. I think I'll bring it next week. That story.
Not next week.
Thank you very much for the correction. 2 weeks after Thanksgiving. Right. So again, she seems to have some sense of superiority and bitterness. She's going completely counter to the culture that she's found in. And she's extremely outspoken. Another source. A certain Min, and a Min is a heretic, and in those days it probably refers to Judeo-Christians. People who are within the Jewish community but have taken upon themselves some belief in the prophethood or the divinity of Jesus. So a certain heretic said to Beruya, "It is written, sing, barren one, you who did not bear children." It's a verse from Isaiah. It's in the Haftarot that we say after, in the weeks following Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, from the book of Isaiah. So this heretic asks her a question. Why, if she did not bear, should she sing? It doesn't make any sense. A barren one should sing. Singing is for people who are happy, but a woman who's barren, she should be sad. So the heretic asks this question. Now, of course, it's interesting that the heretic asked her a question. Why didn't he ask a rabbi? Well, apparently people knew that she knew something. Now, of course, the question he asks relates to women. Perhaps he asked her because she's a woman.
But she did have children.
And she did have children, that's true. Right, it doesn't relate to her personally. Now, in context, let me tell you, the her in context is the Jewish people. It's not an individual woman. In context, well, you see, we'll read the next verse. She replied to him, "You fool, look at the end of the verse, where it says, for the children of the desolate shall be more than the children of the married wife, says God." It's in context. The verse says to the Jewish people, sing, O barren one, because you will have more children than any other woman ever had. Meaning that the Jewish people will multiply and come back to the land of Israel. That's the context. So she says to him, you know, just read the whole verse in context, you'll have an answer. But she prefaces her comment by saying, you fool. So again and again and again we've seen that she is not only assertive, she is, how do you say, she's combative.
Combative.
Right?
And rude.
And rude to men.
Arrogant, yeah.
What is that? In here.
Arrogant.
She's arrogant.
Yeah.
Now again, we can understand what type of arrogance is it. Perhaps it's her defense mechanism, right? Of living in this very, very male-dominated society. And she's not willing to relegate herself to the kitchen or to the bedroom or to wherever she's wanted. She goes out into the public domain and she teaches Torah. And she's probably not wanted where she is. And therefore, she develops this very, very strong armor, it looks like. But then the heretic goes on and asks her further, but what then is the meaning of sing, a barren one that did not bear? The rest of the context explains what it's talking about, but he wants to know that particular phrase taken out of context. It's really not clear why he keeps pushing her. She was right. But he's not willing to take her answer. He asks again. So she says, sing, community of Israel. Again, in the context, the woman is the community of Israel, who resembles a barren woman for not having born children like you for hell. And she says to the heretic, your children are going to go to hell. We're in good shape. So again, we see her very, very caustic nature.
That's great.
Okay, so now hold on to your chairs. Now we get to the big story. All this was preparation I see people are turning the page. You can't resist, right? Preparation for the famous story of Uriah. The Talmud says in Avodah Zarah 18b, then Rabbi Meir ran away to Babylonia. Now, Rabbi Meir was her husband. And we're not telling the story of what came early in the Talmud. We'll get to that later or next week. But all we have is that then Rabbi Meir ran away to Babylonia. And the Talmud says, some say that this was because of this story, and it's a story of his rescue mission of his sister-in-law in the Roman brothel, which we'll tell later. And some say because of the story of Bruria. That's the end of the Talmudic passage. I turn the page. And then I brought Rashi. Remember, Rashi is the commentator in the 12th century of Ashkenaz. And he wants to explain what is this story of Bruria that the Talmud hints about, that because of it, Rabbi Meir fled from Israel to Babylonia. But the Talmud doesn't say what story was it. So Rashi has a tradition of what the story was. Why her husband fled to Babylonia. Here's the story. Very short, but very powerful. Once Bruria made fun of the rabbinic dictum, women are lightheaded. He, meaning Rabbi Meir, said, on your life, he said to her, you will end up admitting that they are right. He commanded one of his students to tempt her into sexual transgression. The student importuned her for many days until in the end she was appeased. Nitratzeit. She agreed. When the matter became known to her, she strangled herself. And Rabbi Meir ran away because of the shame. We can spend days analyzing every word. And I can bring you pages upon pages of commentaries and stories that have been written all in the modern era. Nothing was written about this until 30 years ago. So, let's begin. So first of all, Bruri was making fun of the rabbinic dictum that women are lightheaded. And she said, it's not true. Now let's remember what it could mean. It could mean that women are dumb. They don't know anything. They can't analyze anything. Their minds are not developed, like we saw from that gynecologist at the beginning of the class. But it could also mean something that's not related to the intellectual, but to the emotional, like we saw in the story of Rabbi Shumbar Yochai in the previous class, that women are not strong. They're not able to stand up to temptation. They're not able to hold back in the face of difficult circumstances. If the Romans come and torture my wife, she'll give us away, said Rabbi Shumbar Yochai. So Bruria knows all of this that might be included in the statement that women are lightheaded. And she, of course, bristles. What do you mean? How can you talk about me like that? I'm intelligent. I know Torah. I analyze well. And what do you mean I'm thick? What do you mean I'm lightheaded? What do you mean that I don't stand up in the face of adversity? And she seems very confident of herself. Right? We've seen her statements in the past. She's not afraid of making fun of the rabbis and of their statements. So she's all around saying, women are not lightheaded. I'm the proof. We can understand that. I can't criticize her. But then her husband, Rabbi Meir, he says to her, on your life, you'll end up admitting that they are right, that the rabbis are right. So what type of relationship does Rabbi Meir have with his wife, Bruria? She's wrong, he says. Right?
She's a pistol.
She's a pistol, yeah. And he really thinks that there's something wrong with her, that she's lightheaded just like the other women are.
He just wants to put her in her place.
He wants to put her in her place, mm-hmm. right? Because, I don't know if he loves her or doesn't love her, whatever it is, but women have to know their place. Okay, she's learned a lot of Torah, you have to admit it. But she's still a woman. She's still a woman. She might be intelligent, she might be smart, she might know how to analyze. On those intellectual matters, we can't claim that she's lightheaded. But Rabbi Meir is apparently saying, even if she's intelligent, that doesn't mean that she has a different emotional constitution than all other women. She's weak.
But that's the same as the men, like we studied before.
Very good. Very good.
Smart.
Very good. Very good. But apparently, Rabbi Meir thinks, and the rabbis in general think, that women are weaker, even weaker than men. Yeah. Apparently. They don't say about men, women, men are lightheaded. They say it about women.
Of course.
So he wants to put her in her place. He wants to show her wrong. He can't live with this woman who doesn't know the truth. He won't let her be. I think it's interesting. Of course, we could, again, bring thousands of different opinions and sources here. Here's a Israeli poet translated into English. This is not about Bruria, but it might be, in a certain sense, about Bruria and Rabbi Meir. Yehuda Amichai, a very famous Israeli poet. From the place where we are absolutely right, flowers will never grow in the spring. The place where we are absolutely right is trampled, hardened like a courtyard. However, doubts and loves make the world rise like a dough, like a molehill, like a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the place where a home was destroyed. Now, the reference to the home is an allusion to Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. And he is saying that Jewish salvation, Jewish tikkun, will never come until we learn to live accepting that we're not always right. Others can be right also. You have to be willing to admit that you could be wrong. You should live with a little bit of self-doubt, live with a little bit of lowliness and humility, and not be so filled with the self-important arrogance that says, only I am right. And the reason I bring this here is because it looks like Bruria and Rabbi Meir, they're both scholars, and they're both really smart, and they know that they're smart. And they both know that they're smarter than their spouse. And they both want to prove each other wrong. She says to Rabbi Meir, women are lightheaded nonsense. And he says to her, women are lighted and I'll prove it to you. And he ends up destroying their marriage because he has to prove himself right. That's not a good commentary on Rabbi Meir, of course.
And of course, she can't either live with the fact that she was wrong in some respect here, because
right.
She's got to kill herself.
Oh, that's a good point. Right,
yeah.
Right. She can't live with the humility of having been proved wrong. Yeah, that's really, yeah, that's good. So, going back to the story, he said to her, "You'll end up admitting that they are right." Now, we could have ended there, right? You could have an argument with your spouse, and you can say to your spouse, you'll get yours for voting for Obama or voting for Romney, right? You'll see what happens to this country. You can see spouses saying, I'm right, and you're wrong, and it goes back and forth, and they won't let it be. But Rabbi Meir goes further. He has to prove it. And then what happens here is like, mind-boggling. He says to one of his students, go seduce her. And that's really bad, because she's a married woman.
Yes.
And then you wonder what instructions Rabbi Meir actually gave to the student. Was it seduce her, but stop at the last minute? Or was it seduce her and go all the way? It's hard to believe that the instructions to the student were to go all the way. That's Ten Commandments says don't commit adultery, right? That's really bad stuff. So we don't know, but it could be. I think it's more plausible that the student was supposed to seduce her until the last minute and then stop, either reveal that it was all a plot or not reveal, but not to go through with it. So I don't know exactly what happened. We don't know really what happened. But Rabbi Meir obviously was being very, very, very tough here and very callous to put his wife through that, just to prove a point. So anyway, the Talmudic story says that the student importuned her for many days. Now, what does that mean? Now, we can imagine, I'm looking at the clock, we have time, good. What does that mean? Well, if she sees herself, as we've seen her, as a woman of the intellect, and it's a student that goes to seduce her, what they probably did to get to know each other is to learn Torah. And you can imagine getting to know each other, learning. Of course, she, I'm making this up, but I'm supposing she is probably extremely enamored of this student who's willing to respect her for her mind. And they learn Torah, and they talk, and they get to know each other. And he gains her confidence specifically because he's willing to respect her for the way she sees herself as a student of Torah, as a quote-unquote man, woman of the mind. And in the end, the Torah study leads to tiflut, leads to, or is about to lead to, some type of sexual encounter. And the Talmud said, in the end, she was appeased. She fell for him. We don't know what happened. Okay. So now, there are two different versions of the Talmudic story. I take it back. Two different versions of Rashi's story. Right? This is not in the Talmud. This is Rashi's tradition. So, in the printed editions, it says, the student importuned her for many days until the end she was appeased. When the matter became known to her, she strangled herself and Rabbi Meir ran away because of the shame. In one of the early manuscripts, that's really only about 150, 200 years after Rashi wrote, it says the student importuned her for many days and at the end she was appeased to him. Add those words to him. When the matter became known, and it doesn't say known to her, it just says known, she strangled herself and Rabbi Meir ran away because of the shame. Now, what's the difference between the two manuscripts?
That's a big difference. I mean, the first one, when it says became known to her, it's like the student said, this is what was really happening. You know, I'm not really, you know, out to commit adultery, but this is what your husband asked me to do.
Right.
It came known to her.
Right, exactly.
But the other one, when it became known, is sort of like became known to the public.
Well, of what she did.
Of what she did.
Right, exactly. So it looks like, according to the manuscript one, means she really did something bad. Perhaps the student had not intended to commit adultery, but things got out of hand. And it really happened. And she committed a suicide because her sin became known. Whereas, like Carol Ann said, in the other version, what became known was the plot.
Right.
And it looks like they didn't, in the end, do it. But when it became known to her that her husband tried and almost succeeded in bringing her downfall, that's what made her commit suicide. So it's really two different versions. What caused her to commit suicide? Was it the adultery itself? Or was it her knowledge of what her husband was plotting against her? So now, I brought on the sheets. Yeah?
It was her knowledge that just this situation proved her husband right.
Oh, powerful statement. Powerful statement. Powerful statement.
She didn't want to be wrong.
Yeah.
And she and her husband had this. Really? Maybe that's how she got so tough, living with him. And the two of them would duke it out verbally all the time, I guess.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think?
That's absolutely possible here, right? That she couldn't live with being wrong. Yeah. By the way, are you basing that on which of the two versions in which the adultery took place or didn't take place?
I would say.
Well, you know, it could be either one, because even though the adultery may not actually happen, she was sure heading
right.
there.
She saw her weakness,
yeah.
And she can't live with that weakness. But it's even what you said is even stronger if actually they did go through with it. Yeah. So I have a colleague and a friend and a teacher whose name is Noam Tzion. Some of you might have heard of him. He was a scholar in residence at Sherith Israel 2 years ago, and he gave a class here actually at Melton, a lunchtime class. I've known him since 1976, And this whole class is based on an article that he wrote. And here, on our sheet, I brought five different understandings that he brought up of why she committed suicide. And of those five, the things that have just been said in the room conform to a great extent to what he said. So let's look. First, he suggests that it's failing in virtue, punishment for adultery. Assuming she went through with it, she couldn't live with herself for adultery. And in the Torah, the punishment for adultery is strangulation. So she strangled herself. And Noam here explains what he means by this. She had to maintain her integrity. She accepts moral responsibility for what she did. It's not about her husband, it's about her violation of the Torah. She can't live with herself for violating the Torah, and so she gives herself the punishment that she deserves. That's one possibility. Another possibility, what Noam Tzion calls his second possibility, failing in self-knowledge. It turns out that she didn't know herself, because she thought that she wasn't lightheaded, but she turns out to have been that. So her whole life now has been based on a lie. Maria has been foolish to imagine she could transcend the Noahic sexuality when she's studying Torah. She had a false sense of what she's capable of. Now, Noam brings a quote here from a very well-known rabbi called Mordechai Gafni. Anyone heard of Mordechai Gafni? So we'll read what he wrote, then I'll tell you why he's well-known. We're at the top of the page now. Top of the page. Bruria represents a woman who, just like Rabbi Chiya, and Rabbi Chiya was hinted to, I think, by Fanny earlier. He was the one that was seduced by his wife when his wife dressed up as a prostitute and succeeded in seducing him. Bruria represents a woman who, just like Rabbi Chiya, is incapable of accepting the promiscuous and sensual side of herself. Bruria was a woman who was incapable of really accepting the fact that she was a woman. And she always thought that she wasn't a woman. She wasn't the woman that the rabbis painted. It turns out she's the same woman as the rabbis painted. She feels she's completely failed to understand herself, and therefore she has to commit suicide. Now, Mordechai Gafni is a famous rabbi. I knew him personally. I knew his brother. I knew him a little bit. He was a very, very charismatic, powerful rabbi that was actually accused and later indicted of sexual abuse.
Abuse? Or impropriety? Actual abuse?
Exactly what the case was, I'm not sure. He was married 5 times, as far as I remember.
Yeah.
And he was only 40 years old.
Oh, he was a loose cannon.
Yes, he was a loose cannon. Yeah. A third possible way of looking at why she had to commit suicide is what Noam Tzion calls failing her cause. Bruria may blame herself for failing the cause of woman and allowing the men to chalk up another contrived proof of their libel about all women. And here, it's not that she committed suicide because of what she did, it's because of finding out that it was a plot. And she fell into the clutches of the plot, and she allowed her husband, Rabbi Meir, to prove everything that Rabbi Meir has been saying. So she failed the cause of woman. I really understand that deeply. You know? She saw herself as trying to prove a truth to the world, and she failed in proving that truth. And here, Noam again brings another quote from Mordechai Gafni. Her suicide does not take place at the moment that the sexual act is over, like Rabbi Chiya, who decides to burn himself in the oven, remember that? Immediately after sinning. But rather the moment she became aware that the adulterous act was only a test, whose purpose was to prove her error to her. Bruria could have accepted herself as an adulteress if in the final reckoning it was only her own personal failure. But there was no way that she could bear the shame of admitting defeat to the sages, her husband's colleagues, which meant that she, too, as a woman, is another side, a side which the sages called weak. Again, women's Datan Kala. They're, had I translated earlier, they're lightheaded. So she ends up proving that she's exactly like all the women that have been talked about, and the rabbis are right. So she commits suicide because she can't live with that truth having been proved true. There are two more approaches. Let's read the last one Noam has, is failing her family. And here Noam brings for us the famous story of the martyrdom of Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion, her father. And now this story is found actually in our Machzorim for Yom Kippur, when we talk about the 10 martyrs. So you can see the story here at the bottom of the page. Then they brought up Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion and said to him, "Why have you occupied yourself with Torah, which was forbidden under pain of death?" He said to them, "Thus the Lord my God commanded me." At once they sentenced him to be burned, his wife to be slain, and his daughter to be consigned to a brother. This is the other daughter. This is not Bruria. This is the other daughter. As the three of them went out from the Roman tribunal, they declared their submission to God's righteous judgment. He said, "The divine rock, God's work is perfect, for all God's ways are just." His wife said, "A God is faithful and without sin, just and right." And his daughter said, "Great in counsel, mighty in work, whose eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of men, to give everything according to their ways and according to the fruit of their doing." And then he was burnt at the stake. The Talmud goes on, explains how actually he was now captured by the Romans. They had found Rabbi Hananya ben Tarodion sitting and occupying himself with the Torah, publicly gathering assemblies and keeping a scroll of the law in his bosom. Straight away they took hold of him, wrapped in the scroll of the Torah, this is after the trial of course, placed bundles of branches round him and set them on fire. Then they brought tufts of wool, which they had soaked in water, and placed them over his heart so that he should not expire quickly. And the story goes on and explains how he was able to live and not blaspheme God as he's being burnt alive. So could you imagine, says Noam Sion, here's her father, who is a martyr for Torah. The mother was a martyr for Torah. Her sister was a martyr for Torah. When her brother, remember, went on an evil path, the parents all criticized that son. And now she has given in to sin. She's shaming her whole family. Everything she was brought up to stand for, her father martyred himself and didn't sin, didn't transgress, continued to learn Torah, and she gave in to this seducement and sinned. She can't live with herself because of the shame to her family. That's another way of looking at it. And here, of course, it has nothing to do with the plot against her of her husband. It's just the very act of adultery. And the last approach that Noam Sion brings, with this will end, is number 5. Her husband and Chavruta fail her. And I'll just read it quickly because time is late. How could she not have committed suicide? What's she going to go back to? A husband that did that to her? That betrayed her like that? And not only did her husband betray her, the Torah betrayed her. Because as I had said earlier, probably the way the student seduced is by learning with her. By studying. So the Torah world itself, as represented by her husband and the student, completely betrayed her. Why should she live? Why should she learn Torah anymore? Why should she be married? There's nothing left to her life. The credibility of Torah has been destroyed, and the credibility of her husband has been destroyed. There's no other way to live except to die. So she commits suicide. And of course, Rabbi Meir then flees to Babylonia because look what he's done. It was all his fault. Terrible, terrible, tragic ending to what? To a woman learning Torah. But of course, there's an indictment there, not only of Bruria learning Torah, there's a serious indictment of the Torah world and what it did to this woman. Mm-hmm. And next time, we'll continue with more stories of Bruria, I think, not from this sheet, but from other sources.